That would be tough for me.
Oof.
Right now.
Everybody. All right. Good morning, everyone. This is Commissioner Brian Kalk. It is Tuesday, September 24th, approximately 8:30 in the morning. We're meeting for our first work session, and I say that first because I don't intend to solve the whole rate case in the next hour or so. It's for case number PU 12-813, the first chance the commission has got together as a commission after we've had the rate case hearings. A lot of work taking place up to this point, and so I would see if Randy or Julie, Commissioners Fedorchuk or Kristen, have any comments, and we'll get started on the discussion.
I don't have any major opening comments, just talked with staff a little bit yesterday about some of the procedures, and so being this is our first rate case, yep. I'm kind of curious how we work through all these issues now, so I'll look forward to your experience in helping us through this process.
See what we can do. Okay.
Thanks.
I would just say ditto that, and I'm waiting to hear the responses to some of the further filings that were going to happen and that sort of thing. I'm not sure where we're at with gathering the new information, but whatever time it takes, I guess we'll figure through it.
All right, perfect.
If I might ask to, I believe that the attorneys were all working afterwards on a summary of the issues, right? Yeah. No, there was going to be a list of the...
There was proposed orders, but there's a list of late-filed exhibits, and I was just trying to figure out if they were here. I have not seen them. I don't think they're here. John was going to double-check the docket.
There was also a list of some of the financials. NSP's attorney was going to put together a list of here's where we're at and here's where they're
yes.
at, or it was a kind of in one sheet.
Kind of the numbers if they
yes.
could agree, and if they could agree even on what the differences are.
Right.
And if not, two sheets. Yes, I don't know that we have any of that, and again, I thought I might have a list for you, but I don't. I just haven't seen any of it. So
okay.
We are waiting, and I'm sure that the proposed findings would not be done until after that.
Did we even ask for proposed findings?
The ALJ did.
Oh, findings,
yes. I do
not
believe there was a deadline. And there could be some issues that need legal briefing that would go with it from both sides.
Okay. All right.
Okay, I remember your point, though, because I remember the companies talked back and forth, and you said, well, that'd be a very helpful piece of equipment to have. I remember exactly what you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Because that kind of, this is the first chance for the three of us to talk, and I've been through a couple rate cases, but every one has been different.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'll say that, what we've seen before is the commission has met before, the three of us, and we'll talk a little bit, and then miraculously a settlement agreement will drop out of the sky, and then next thing you know, the discussion shifts to what we think on the settlement agreement, so that's one thing that could happen. We've seen another rate case where we went through every point line by line and ended up being a 2-1 vote, and that could certainly happen here again. And then someplace or a hybrid system where a partial settlement agreement will be filed, and then it'll be we agree on everything but these one or two key points. So I don't think there's one thing that might happen, but I just wanted to, see if there's something that we're missing of just when I took down the notes of the first attorney, if you will, she kind of laid out the points about what she thought was going to be the key points, and I think that the company did a good job laying those out. I think our staff did the same thing, but I didn't see, I just want to go through and make sure I'm not missing anything, but there was the 12 CP versus the 1 CP. That's something I'll have to sit down with staff individually and get some thoughts on, but that one I could see pros and cons both ways. The depreciation, that's one I think that'll kind of work itself out. The return on equity, I said in the beginning, and I still see that for me personally, is a very key issue. And so I'm still along that one. I think I can be swayed either way on that. If the company has a desire to give us some certainty they're not going to be back here again in the next couple of years, I'd be more likely to follow a higher return on equity. But if I get the sense that they're going to be back here every year, I don't see any incentive at all to follow the one expert testimony said they're going to be back here every year anyway. So why not just give them the lower amount? I thought that was very candid testimony. So, the employee compensation and pensions, I can go almost any way on that, given the arguments that I've heard. The fuel cost rider, once again, I can probably go any way on that, but my experience with riders has been getting rid of riders is probably a good idea. But I don't know if Jared and Alana, I'm just going to set the table.
Is that the transition rider or the fuel cost rider?
Fuel cost rider.
Okay.
And that one, I don't know if that ties into the wind. The incentive compensation, I think, kind of wait to see what the Minnesota decision is a little bit to look at that. But that one, I have some thoughts there. Charitable contributions, we really put the kibosh on those in the past. I just have a hard time philosophically taking money that's ratepayer money and giving it out for charitable contributions. We, in Otter Tail rate case, the first one I think I really remember with is we gave them a phase out. And so that's kind of where I'm at right now. I don't see where charitable contributions, not that they're not worthwhile, but I don't, what's that, Alana? Yeah, I just don't see that. And then the transmission cost recovery rider, that one, I want to hear some more thoughts from Jerry on that. But those are the issues that I wrote down. Everything else I heard, I don't have any really particular thoughts on. So from that point, I'm not really sure what the next step up is. If, you know, Randy and Julie, if you guys have, if there's something we know right up front that we can kind of put to the side, or if the only thing that I've really pretty committed to at this point is the ROE discussion and the charitable contributions, I see those pretty clear right now. But the rest of them, I'm certainly open to hearing everybody's thoughts on.
Well, just for clarity, to me, the obvious thing, when you talk about charitable contributions, are you talking about charitable contributions and economic development contributions, or do you differentiate between those?
I don't think I would differentiate. Anything that takes ratepayer dollar and gives the company latitude to pick who gets it, I think I view that the same.
Well, I tend to agree with you, and I guess the one exception I would have is, and this isn't an NSP example necessarily, but I'm sure a lot of companies do these kinds of things, so maybe they have done similar things, but one or maybe multiple oil companies put a bunch of money into UND to get a petroleum engineering program going, because they needed that so they'd have some new young petroleum engineers, and it wasn't happening without some investment. Something like that, I can see sometimes where there might be a benefit to the company in some type of a training program. Or probably a better example is what a couple of our industrial equipment manufacturers are doing down at North Dakota State College of Science, so they get some diesel mechanics and that are well-trained, and they needed a shop, and they worked on doing that. So, you know, maybe there's some exceptions, but I sure need some persuading, and generally I tend to agree with you that when it's just something for the company to be able to give out to be nice and generous in the community, I don't think that that's a responsibility necessarily of the ratepayers.
Right.
I agree. Also with the economic development and the charitable donations, it's got benefit to the company, but the ratepayers, I don't think that the ratepayers should be paying for that. The employee compensation packages, I felt that those were the company established fairly credibly that it's their whole pay structure. So if you take that away, it's you're taking out a component of a huge component of their salary structures, which, you know, pays the employees who work for the company. And I don't feel that that's a misuse of ratepayer dollars. So I was not I'm not real concerned about the incentive pay or whatever, I forget exactly what term they called it. I'd like more information from staff on the depreciation issue, so maybe I'll sit down with Patrick, since I now realize he's a depreciation
expert
and talk through some of the issues there, because I thought that the advocacy staff and the company were really far apart on that issue and saying very different things. So I want to dig into that a little bit more. The 12 CP versus the 1 CP, and there again, I don't know that either of them are perfect, so, or reflective of the current environment in this industry. It seems like an update is needed, and perhaps we need to set the stage somehow for that happening on a longer term scale, not in the next couple of months during, you know, to be included in this rate case. So, but I definitely think there needs to be something developed to examine those methodologies in the current environment of regional transmission organizations. So,
that's a key point of how those tie into the RTOs.
Mm-hmm.
Comment on that, just on the 12 CP versus 1 CP. Who was the advocacy person that was talking about?
Pavlovic.
Talked about, my note that I made anyway, recommended adopting a 1 CP method with the instruction to NSP to develop a more accurate method, which kind of told me maybe he didn't feel the 1 CP method was necessarily perfect either.
He said before that on the record that he was wrong recommending 1 CP. He corrected himself.
Okay.
And then said, but go ahead and make him do that temporarily.
So the note that I put down, I don't think he said this. This, by my notes, is what I had in my mind. If we're not confident in the 1 CP method either and really want something better than either option, I'm not sure it'd be right to ask the company to jump over here into this hoop until we get something better. But perhaps the 1 CP method ought to be something that's on the horizon and is going to be the reality as of a given date, unless they come up with something better. And, you know, I think if, as long as the 12 CP is there and that's what the company likes, that's what they'll never come up with something better. And if we do 1 CP immediately, like I say, I'm not sure that would be right. But if they knew that as of a certain date, it goes to 1 CP, I'm guessing that before that date, if it was a reasonable time frame, they might come to us with a better proposal.
You don't have a record for that, though.
Here you go again, the details.
Yeah, the details. You really don't, because you had your analysis from the staff for the one. Good or bad, you could have just, you know, decided, I believe him, I don't believe him. But when he got on the witness stand, he said, now that I've heard what I heard at this hearing, which I didn't get before, and we don't know why, if they didn't ask or they didn't answer or what. But now that I've heard what I've heard, 1 CP is not correct either.
Mm-hmm.
But
so you might say we're going to something. I mean,
my note, Alana, is that he still recommended adoption of
this
with the instruction to NSP to develop a more accurate method.
But he had no base. He has no factual basis for that. That's the problem, because he doesn't want to deviate too much from his testimony. And then I asked him why. I tried to get from him a basis for defaulting, so to speak, to the one until you do something better versus staying where you are until you do something better, because you have your previous record for what the 12 for the 12 CP. And I just didn't hear an answer. Oh, we can all double check, but
I remember him saying
that question. Yeah.
What I remember him saying to that was, if you switch to the 1 CP, so the company's motivated to change. If you stay with the 12 CP, they won't be motivated. But I think we could develop in our order the parameters that motivates them, you know, whether it's a deadline or whatever it is.
Deadlines would be,
I mean,
really good.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think there probably are some better methods out there, but we didn't hear about them.
Yeah.
Jerry, did you have any thoughts about how the different CPs tie into playing in MISO and the MISO markets, that one is better or worse in the way MISO operates?
Thanks.
You know, I don't tie it back to MISO too much.
Okay.
There's off and on peak periods in MISO just like everywhere else, and your shoulder months and stuff like that do contribute to your costs because you can schedule maintenance and stuff from plants and things like that. There's down periods during lesser peaks, and so how much of a load you have in September is probably relevant. Not as relevant as how much load you have in August or July when you're peaking for a summer peaker.
But it would be better for MISO to track these if companies all use the 12 CP?
Well, the 12 CP is more us and the states around us. From NSP's perspective, they've got all of the states on the same allocation method right now. And that's been a battle over the years. And if we switch, will the other states switch too? Would they switch to the same thing? If that doesn't happen, then all of the parts don't add up to a hole for them.
Sure, like he was testifying to.
Yeah, and that is the big issue with it from the company's perspective. I don't know if they care as much as to what the method is as much as they care
recovery.
That everybody's on the same page.
It struck me during the hearing that North Dakota, according to advocacy, we might be on the short end of the stick on the 12 CP, and it might not be the best for our state. Maybe it is good for Minnesota and South Dakota because we're then paying some of what they should be paying. So that's where it's like I understand the companies need to have something that equals up to 100%. Yeah. But at what point do we test it and push it a little bit to make sure that we're not the ones bearing that burden, our ratepayers, more than South Dakota and Minnesota?
And you know, we did this once before with Dale Sandstrom, and he came up with a method that was different from anything. He would weight the peaks from the different months.
It was called a weighted 12 CP.
Yeah, and there was, I don't think, no discussion. There was some discussion, I guess, in the record around it, but, I mean, he came up with this, and they voted, and they put it in place after the rate case in that order. I mean, they didn't have a good, strong record that said this was the best. They just did it.
They didn't have an expert saying, weighted 12 CP is what I recommend. But they had all the facts. I mean, the same kind of facts you heard here. What are the things that go into choosing a method? Summer peak, winter peak, maintenance on the shoulders. So they had all of that, and from listening to that, obviously at least one commissioner said to himself, well, I can understand all the months, but some of them are more important than others.
Yep.
You know, so the facts were in the record. There wasn't a
Wasn't there a follow-on to that person. Story, though, when he left the commission and Susan came and they kind of reverted back to where they were before?
Yeah.
Yep.
Yep.
Yep. I mean, there was a reconsideration.
On that same order.
But again, that's where somebody comes in, a party comes in and asks for a reconsideration and makes a case. Either the evidence was more this way or I want to bring some more evidence in. And the commission granted that reconsideration. I don't remember if there was more evidence or if it was just a reconsideration on the record evidence.
So that's the council here. Whatever we do, this has been a controversial issue before, that if we don't have a solid record on what we do, we set ourselves up for the same scenario.
Yeah. And the real concern that I have on choosing one or the other right here is that your underlying evidence, you have your expert saying, I listened to 2 days of underlying evidence more than I had when I researched it, and I now realize what I said isn't the right method either. So that part, that's you know, concerning as far as picking one CP today. I think maybe, it's best to require some investigation into the right method with more information. Because you got
is
kind
that
of
as
canned,
part of this, and then
got the
order
canned stuff in right. this case. Mm-hmm. The first
is that for this consideration then in what we determine in this case, or is that for afterwards and for future?
Well, I think it goes to, let's just look at it from one issue, but this would apply to every issue you have. You have an existing order and the question from before, and I know you don't have to follow what was done before, but the point is, do you have a basis, do you have a record, factual basis to change on the CP? And so if you don't, then you would be saying that in this order. You might say, now I have a record not to change to something, because I don't know what, but I have a record that there's a lot more questions here that need to be answered. Mm-hmm. And so I'm going to make you answer them within a certain time. But you can you would decide the case based on the fact that you had no factual basis to change.
Well,
I mean, that's
so
the way
you have
I see
to
those
have,
facts.
You have to have the facts, factual basis for this specific method. It isn't enough that the advocacy outlined some serious problems with the 12 CP. They had to have a viable alternative, in your opinion, that would be stronger for selecting a different model.
Not necessarily, but what they said in this case, they didn't come in and say, there's all these problems with 12 CP, and we don't know what the right answer is. You need to go investigate. They kind of said that at the end, but in the beginning, that's not the testimony. The testimony is all these problems with 12 CP for the way costs are allocated in North Dakota, and we think the 1 CP is the right way. The problem is that the man who said that changed his mind after listening to the rest of the NSC.
Before
story.
We get wrapped around all the legal stuff, which I agree there is a point here, and I'm not saying this is what I think, but the commissioners could say, we believe 1 CP best represents the needs of the consumers, and that's it. I mean,
you
we could
say that, I guess.
We could
you
do
could
that.
Say that.
I mean, and we could just the argument that Jerry just said. So there's I appreciate that, and I'm the first to say we need to make sure we have ourselves set up for an appeal. But there's also, if we go through this with everything we decide, we got to tie back to a certain point in the record. That's not the intent of these things.
No, but it is the standard for appeal.
You're correct.
Your findings, your record has to support your findings and your findings.
And there could be the companies and the advocacy staff could be listening and see this is a very contentious point.
Yeah.
And they could just agree they're going to agree on something as a larger package. And the settlement agreement has no basis of what was decided in the record.
Can we invite an expert in these, an impartial one, to give us more information? Or is that not allowed at this point?
You would be opening, you would do additional evidence, just like you were asked to do in one of those citing cases. And
okay.
You would say, I want to take consideration of additional evidence on, and you can narrow it to the one issue and you could decide all the rest, even if that one took a little longer.
And
that would allow cross-examination.
I think in fairness, unless I have my notes wrong, but the way I listen to things, Mr. Pavlovic acknowledged some issues that he hadn't come up with before, but he still did recommend adoption of the 1 CP. Mm-hmm. So,
mm-hmm. You know, the problem with this subject is that if everybody starts looking at it from the perspective of what it should be, they're going to be looking at what is it that will make me have to pay the least, mm-hmm. and you'll never get the, everybody will have their own method in all of the states, and you won't get an agreement on it. But it would be nice if all the states were able to get together and talk this out and decide what was the best for everybody. But
that's why I asked the MISO question. Okay, so let's just table this, if that's okay, mm-hmm. guess, for a while. But clearly there's a lot of room in this one. Before I had a note here I forgot to bring up in the beginning. I wanted to talk to staff and my colleagues about the discussion on this separate wind hearing, if you will.
Yeah.
I wasn't sure how that was left, according to what all of you thought.
I thought the record said that that's what the parties wanted to do.
Okay, so does everybody agree on that, I guess?
I wasn't sure what your what your question is. Are you talking about all the purchase power?
Right, all the purchase power agreements that were not in there, and there was a note that one of the members of the advocacy staff had interpretation of it. And
I thought that I heard something to this effect, but that's why I asked. When they produced that big list of the purchase power, they were going to produce a further one with what do they both think should be in, out, separate, whatever, and whether staff agreed or disagreed, because I was a little confused. That isn't here yet. The list isn't here.
It wasn't clear as to whether the discussion on the seabed projects and the solar and all of that stuff, it was clear that staff wants it out. It wasn't clear if they were willing to move all of that into the next proceeding or if we were just looking at those wind contracts that we had noticed here.
Okay. So we're waiting.
We didn't know, part of the problem is we didn't notice.
We didn't notice on this next meeting.
Yeah, that's part of that problem. But we were trying to see if there could be an agreement on this exhibit, or even more, an agreement between them, a little mini stipulation that said, here's what we both think should be done with all these cases. That's so I was still confused about the record, but and waiting for this.
Yeah, I thought that staff wanted the seabed and stuff out as part of this decision.
Okay, so that's a wait and see then, too. All right. I also had a note here. I asked Josh to sit in here, and I might have made a tactical error with including Josh in this meeting in the sense we didn't have full background of what I wanted him to be. I just wanted to start bringing in newer staff into commission advisor, and the way I understand it is that unless somebody's listed as advocacy staff, everyone else is commission advisor. So I asked Josh to sit in and listen, and I probably didn't flesh that out with the two of you. So Josh had a memo he put together and some things, which I think was a good start, but he rescinded it, and that's fine because it was not probably set up as looking at what the record evidence was. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to make sure everybody's agreement or clear on that. That's the way I see it. And now he's here to give us his background.
I see it.
Okay. But so that's where Randy and Julie is. I don't think I even talked to really anybody about it. I should have. And maybe had Josh sit in too, but it's just a way of return and equity. I would like to get your three opinion, maybe not this second, but with some look at the record, and I think there's a record that says we can go either way in this one.
And anywhere in between.
And anywhere in between. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, that's where I'm more tied into the ROE as a tool, quite honestly. If we end up having an ROE that, not appropriate. I guess that's where I'll leave it right now. I just see if Randy and Julie have any thoughts that we can go from my jump-off point. If not, we'll just carry that to the next meeting too.
What I don't know what you asked.
Okay, my point, where I'm at in ROE is I believe there's a record either way that says we can give them the lowest possible amount or the amount they're requesting. I think there's a solid record that says we can do that. I'm looking at ROE as if I get a sense that the company is going to be back here next year, which I already have that sense, I'm inclined to give them a 9.0 ROE and we'll deal with them next year. If there's some latitude that the company's willing to submit themselves and not coming back for 2-3 years, then I think that I would be going the other way. Now maybe that's not the right way to look at it, but I think it is because these rate cases take a lot of time and a lot of work, a lot of customer dollars, and so more likely to give them the higher ROE so that they don't spend as much ratepayer dollars coming back here every year or two.
They'll be back.
Well, I agree. Jerry, I believe they're absolutely coming back, so I have zero desire to do anything else than an ROE above a 9.0. So that's kind of where I'm at right now. That's where I was just curious if you two have any, not decisions, but any general thoughts.
Although the term of what we expect this agreement to be might be one factor. I think it's just one factor. And one of the things that I had down is that they were going to bring statements from analysts who downgraded ratings in other jurisdictions. Because I don't know if it was me or someone else, asked a question of, okay, they got downgraded and they had a lower ROE than we did. but that doesn't necessarily mean that that's why they were downgraded. Mm-hmm. I would like to read those statements and find out if it was this or something else or a combination. And I think that's just an important part of my decision-making process on what this ought to be.
Where were those?
Well, we heard from the company, and we talked a lot about that. South Dakota was the one that had a lower ROE, and they right. and we were told that they were downgraded.
Right.
And then we had the, I didn't know if they were going to bring the statements or they got the treasurer on the phone, and we talked to him about it.
I had a note that they were going to provide the statements okay. of the analysts.
And that yeah. must be one of the late filed exhibits, but I'll double check to make sure it's in there. And if not, staff will simply write a letter and ask for it, or an email and ask for it.
And you want to know that the downgrading was a result of the ROE?
Or what correct. The reasoning was.
Okay.
And didn't it happen in Minnesota, too, that they're not as low as South Dakota, but aren't they?
I don't believe they were the ones that were downgraded, though. At least I don't remember that. I remember them talking about South Dakota being downgraded.
Is Minnesota's ROE 9.75? Am I remembering that correctly?
I don't remember.
Their current one? I'm not sure.
Dave would know. Dave would know if you wanted to ask.
Well, let's ask him. Can we?
You can.
Okay.
If he comes up to a mic, please.
Okay, 9.83.
All right.
9.83. Okay. Thanks, Dave.
You know, from a practical perspective, for me, it's kind of hard to imagine that our little itty-bitty corner of the world over here could influence the Wall Street analysts on what happens with NSP.
Even though we're a small percentage.
Based on whether or not we give them one or a percentage up or down either way on our 5% of their load. I mean, but there may be some value to we are perceived as being a friendly regulatory environment.
Mm-hmm.
Probably even compared to Minnesota. So,
and we asked some people, I don't think it might have been Commissioner Fedorchuk or somebody, asked a few questions about how little North Dakota could impact or not impact ROE. And that might,
yeah,
the real answer might be coming in the statements. I don't know.
Didn't the witness that testified on the phone basically said, well, it doesn't help, but I can't say conclusively that it hurts. I mean, that's what I got out of his testimony is you can't really, there's nothing quantitative about how they make these decisions. It's they sit in a room and they come up with what they think it is. So, okay, so that's where you need some more info. How about, Jules, do you have any thoughts on that yet?
I don't yet.
Okay. Fair enough. You talked about employee compensation pensions, so did I. Do you have any things that you're looking for particularly on that question, Randy?
Yes, I do. On the pensions.
Okay.
The rate of return on these defined benefit plans that they're expecting from their investments, I just think is a key element in this. You know, you can build a defined benefit pension plan and assume a rate of return on your investment of 20%. And then when it's short, and it's going to be, people are supposed to pick up the cost of that. Well, you knew it was going to be short. You knew you're not going to, year in a year, I'll get 20%. We don't even know what percent their defined benefit pension plan is based on. And I think that is a key element in my understanding of whether we're asking ratepayers to make up losses in a plan that's built knowing it's not going to work, as opposed to picking up the cost for something that was unforeseen and is an important part of keeping good employees at a company where we expect good service. And so it may be reasonable, it may not, but I have to know more about how they're defining those benefits and coming up with a way to make good on them.
So how could we just talk through this a little bit? How could we put some discipline in the system where ratepayers are not necessarily on the hook if their returns are not what they expect them to be? Do you have any just general thoughts to anybody about that?
Well, my thought is it's kind of kind of a smell test. If they're building the pension payouts based on an expected rate of return of, you know, 10 or 11%, you just know history doesn't indicate that you're going to accomplish that. If it's 5 or 6% or something like that, you know, it's probably more realistic. And so if it's built to fail, then I don't think our ratepayers ought to be expected to float it.
But how could we do that in an order? Let's say we agree with all that and we have a record. I mean, how do we put something like that in an order? I don't know.
If it looks like it's built to fail, then I just don't think that the ratepayers ought to be responsible for it.
I'm hearing slightly two different things. One would be if you learned from one of those, I think, late filed exhibits, I think that was another question supposed to come in, that it was unreasonably high, knowing that the ratepayers are there to pick up the slack. You would disallow, is what I'm hearing, Commissioner Chrisman, disallow or apportion. And what I'm hearing here is going forward, something to motivate that, you know, ratepayers are only going to pay up to a certain
or somewhere
percent.
In the middle. Because, yeah. I mean, could you just disallow the whole thing? I guess you could.
We used to just pay the whole thing for current retirees now. And then there was some rules changes with FASB and stuff that made them start to set it aside as you go. And so there was a transition period from paying everything up front. And or everything now for all your current employees or that are retired, or paying for your employees that are working now, putting some money away for them to retire later. And so I don't know. It's an issue. You need a professional accounting advice to.
That's what Josh is here to become, our professional accounting.
So you're saying there's rules governing what can and can't be done there.
Not outside rules governing what you can let ratepayers pay. Those are for how you account and how you have reserves and those kinds of
There's
things.
There's a research topic for you, Josh.
What the ratepayers can pay for or not is totally within your discretion based on the based on a record and based on reasonableness and a constitutional taking.
But I think Randy's got a good point there. But so you could do a range of allow zero. Mm-hmm. You could allow it all. You could allow up to a certain dollar amount or percentage.
Mm-hmm.
That would be the range of options.
I believe. I mean, I'd have to, this one's not coming back from memory real easily. But I mean,
the MDU case, we talked about this quite a bit, but I don't think we ever did anything different at the end of it. I think we just said, okay, we trust what you're doing, and we agreed, and we moved on. I don't know if you remember that one.
We put something in the order. We wrote some kind of a paragraph for Commissioner Clark, and I don't remember it.
Okay, so we should maybe look at that language, because I know that Tony asked a lot of questions about it, and that's what spawned my questions in the hearing, is remembering Tony's discussion about it. But I could not remember what we did.
Yeah, and I mean, we do have some. It was like in the might have been in the ordering clauses. I'm looking to Pat for help here. You don't remember, but yeah. Okay, we'll have to see what we did. Yeah.
Okay.
And if it might not be about the same exact issue. We'll look it up.
Generally, though, I think these pension costs. I don't know. It just had to be built into the ordinary course of business, and not be something that we need special additional revenues to make up a pension.
You would think.
Shortfall.
Mm-hmm.
And so.
Of course, we all do. That's what the state's doing, is getting some special additional revenues to make up a shortfall. I mean, everybody's doing it from that depression.
It's a complicated subject.
It's what the state's doing, but many others are ending their defined benefit plans or redefining their definitions.
Yes.
And if these are unrealistic, then I think before we allow it, there ought to be some potential redefining done.
Well, that's another area where I will be double-checking what's already been told to the company to submit, because it's possible you may need something further submitted.
Okay. Julie, any other thoughts on that one?
Not on that one.
I had a back. Oh, go ahead.
we go back to ROE for a minute?
Yeah, I was just going to head back there to you first.
Couple of thoughts on the ROE and what I was intrigued about in this discussion, just so that I can maybe get some of your guys' input, your Randy and Brian. But so I understand the companies need to have a reasonable ROE when they're trying to attract capital for this build cycle that they're in. I understand that need. And the history of having it be reasonable and comparable to what's being offered in other states and all that sort of thing. But at the end, I think it was it King? Was he the advocacy? Mm-hmm. He did make an interesting point about, you know, if you've got a low ROE and nobody wants to buy that, you know, nobody wants to invest in those companies because the ROE is too small. That's the theory, that it's hard to get investors. He made an interesting point in saying, well, if the price drops, then you're going to be appealing to new investors because it's a lower price and it's a better deal. And I thought that was a good point, an interesting counter to this notion that, gosh, you're not going to be able to find any money to invest. Well, is that really realistic? Or has that been kind of the traditional stance to support, you know, the company's ROEs in the past? I was really intrigued at one point. I don't remember who said it, but the point of, I asked a fair amount of questions about the ROE being, is it important to have an ROE that's high or being able to earn the ROE, actually, which they aren't actually doing here in North Dakota. Right. And I think it was a company person, but I could be wrong, saying that they'd really like to have our help in setting up a structure so that they can earn their ROE.
Actually, King answered you. Well, in one conversation, King said it's not that terrible to have a low set ROE if the rest of your rate structure is accurate and they can actually earn it.
Yeah.
King said that to you, which I thought was very telling also.
And accurate,
yeah.
You have 11% ROE and you're making 7%, what's the point?
Yeah, it doesn't seem like that's of huge value to the company. And if there are mechanisms that we can help improve upon to help decrease that gap and help the company, I'm interested in knowing what they are, what's in our orders that are preventing them from earning the ROE, what's in our regulatory environment, if it is a regulatory issue, if it's just a company management issue, I don't know. So
that's a fair question, though, that I can't even begin to answer what causes them to earn their ROE or not cause it. That's another research fault.
Well, it's
more of a spending problem.
But
it's their own management of money?
Yeah. I don't know without looking at their books. ROE is basically net income divided by equity, so their costs have exceeded where they plan. There's no cost control built in to the system. I don't know without digging into where those compared to previous years and budgets, where those variances are.
It doesn't necessarily indicate whether it was reckless spending or necessary spending. It just means that
spending occurred higher than
costs
maybe
they
were anticipated.
Higher.
Well, and you have the revenues also. So what I thought King was getting at was, yes, if you do the 1 CP, let's say, and you're $20 million short, they're probably not going to earn 10, 9, 11, or 2. So whatever. I mean, the point is,
not just spending.
You have to allow recovery of proper costs so that their revenues can be up there. And they're going to say your orders didn't allow enough recovery, and the other side is going to say you're overspending.
Yeah.
Sure. But what I would agree with you, Julie, anything that we could do to help them earn what we say they could earn, I'm okay with that. That just makes
sense. Alana makes a very good point there on the 1CP thing. If you don't pay your share on the allocation, the way things are set up, well, then their earnings are less.
On a similar note for the ROE, is that I like the idea of having a collar on it, too. If we say 9% ROE, and if they're making above a certain point, they have to come back and they keep some, and the ratepayers keep some.
Well, or that would be a justification for a higher ROE.
And we've done those kind of things, I think, through settlement where the companies have agreed to it before.
Yes, and on PBR.
Without them agreeing to do it. It's more like you would call, you're earning too much, call, you're coming back in, would be your response if you thought their earnings were high rather than saying.
Okay, so it's their choice.
Revenue share, yeah. We talked about that in the hearing, and it's somebody testified that it was fairly commonly used. And
is it ordering?
I thought it was, I could have misunderstood, though.
No,
thought it was,
there was discussion, I think, from both sides, and I think from one of the staff witnesses because of experience in other states.
Yep.
But who, I have no idea.
No, it was one of their witnesses.
Okay.
It was the gal. She was not a company employee, though.
She was the consultant.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, so she had experience elsewhere.
Yep, and I don't know if she was saying their company likes it, but I think it was Sharon.
Yeah.
Oh, no, she was the...
But I don't recall if she said, you know, that it was litigated and then ordered as opposed to a settlement. There's so many different statutes and ways on all the other states that...
I know that you can't get look backwards and say you made too much, give some back.
Right.
You said you can't do that?
No.
If they are willing to do it, it's sort of retroactive rate making. That's what he's getting at. You can't impose something that's retroactive. The rates go forward.
Yeah.
That's why companies didn't come in here for 30 years on rate cases.
That's right.
Because they were making lots of money and they didn't want to come back. And then when they came back, they may have over-earned for the last 20 years, but they still asked for a rate of increase going forward because they needed it. But that's the way the law is set up. Okay. All right, so that was fuel cost rider. I had that down as a key point. Does that go away depending how this wind thing shakes out? If all these wind farms drop away, is that still a center issue to this case?
There were two issues on the wind farms. There's the ones that are pending approval.
Right.
And the stuff that's already built.
So it is an issue no matter
how. And there's really three because Geronimo specifically has to be decided in this rate case. And then there's the ones that are just in there that nobody ever talked about before, and then there's the going forward ones.
So will that
and then there's coal and nuke.
Will that be flushed out in that piece of paper we get?
Some of it would. The wind stuff. But the fuel cost rider is bigger. It's all the fuel that you've always run through there, like a nuclear.
Why don't you like fuel cost riders, Brian?
Well,
I'm just curious.
Here was the issue, I think, and please, staff, correct me if I'm wrong, but if we allow a company to continue to pass things through on a fuel cost rider, they can be popping up wind farms all over the place and run those costs of that wind farm power purchase agreement through the cost rider, and we never see it. So what we're doing is we're giving a company...
That's only because we allow it.
Okay.
Challenge it would mean a staff case with no resources. We talked about that on the record, too.
Or a change to require them.
Or change a change in the rule.
So, Julie, I'm not against the rider. Like, Otter Tail's got some riders now that they put in place for wind farms. Every year they come in, they true them up, and there's already a process that the commission went through to say this is a good project. Now they true up their costs every year. That kind of rider makes sense. But the way I understood now, when they can go out and buy these purchase power agreements, flow them through this rider, we never even see it. So we're basically giving away our ability to say we like or don't like how they're getting their generation. And we could have a company that has 40% wind, and they've shifted their fuel mix without us even being aware of it.
Well, some of the not seeing it or not noticing it, we've brought on ourselves because we've streamlined how those monthly fuel adjustments come in.
Well, I agree, but we never anticipated that the companies would use them in this manner.
But I'm only bringing it up because there's probably a few little things that you just could start to do. As Jerry said, we allow it. You could stop. You could look at it. You could ask for more information, whatever. You also could open a case to sort of investigate what's in the fuel adjustments that you would bear the cost of. And we talked a little bit about whether the company was willing to do that and perhaps help find a way to fund it, even though it's not officially in the statute how you can fund it. But then the bigger picture, purchase power costs is in the rules. I mean, and it didn't used to be wind farm because there weren't any. It was where, if you had to buy power for, an emergency from Manitoba or something, the right. purchase power would go through there. And plus, I guess the whole base Manitoba purchase goes through there. But, you know, 15 years ago wasn't an issue. Now it's wind farms like this or biomass or whatever they're, mm-hmm. whatever they're buying. So you can, you, I think what you want to do is think about what way you want to try to address it, or all three ways.
But isn't the impact to the consumer, this is the way I see the impact to the consumer, is we can be driving up, customers' rates can be going up, ding, 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 because they continue to buy more purchase power for high-cost electricity instead of building their own baseload
yes.
generation at much lower costs.
Yes.
So we could be driving up the cost, we would be driving up the cost to the consumers without ever seeing
yes.
what's going on.
If it just comes in and nobody looks twice to stop it.
From their perspective, though, when they're going into these contracts, that's an expense for them. There's no investment there. So if they're building their own plant, they're making an investment in that plant and getting a return on that
yes.
investment.
So is that why their ROE might not, they might, can't make their ROEs because of all these purchase power agreements?
No.
Yeah, I don't think it's that
okay.
simple.
We got a fuel cost adjustment that gets them that money back.
Okay.
But they're not earning any
yeah.
profit or return on it. If they go and build a plant, then that plant goes into rate base and they get the 9
yeah.
some
and
percent ROR.
The Otter Tail examples are Otter Tail investment, capital investment that we have riders to cover.
Right,
so,
exactly.
Yeah.
Different
I mean,
model, but they're, the,
yeah.
the tariff in that case, I think, makes sense. I don't know if that begins to answer your question.
Well, yeah, no, we're just interested in your thoughts on that. I mean, it is a philosophical and kind of a
absolutely.
Macro level issue of how to deal with purchase power.
Yes.
How, if you didn't do it in a fuel cost rider, how would you do it? Rate case?
Yeah, and in some cases they just set a base level of fuel costs, and it's up to the company to recover that, or more or less, depending on what they actually spend on it. And if they can't, they come in for a rate case.
Say that once more, Jerry.
If they can't recover their costs for their fuel,
okay.
along with everything else, they come in for a rate yeah. case.
With their normal,
yep.
with their normal yeah. rate structure and
ROE
and stuff.
You
yeah.
put some
so the,
number in rates.
So the purpose of the, one of the purposes of the fuel cost adjustment was to stop them from having to come in every year for rate cases.
Which mm-hmm. they're doing now anyway.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the other purpose is if they're saving money for something, you know, just go back to the olden days, it's only coal and the price of coal plummets and you've got this higher amount in rates.
Yep.
Then they're making more than they need. You're not people aren't benefiting from the price of coal plummeting.
But it does also work the other way with these fuel cost adjustments. If the cost of fuel goes down, it has been volatile, the savings gets returned
yeah.
to the customer,
right.
too.
I mean, in some respects, I like it for that reason. It's reflective of what they're paying now. When it's a fuel, but when it's a purchase power, it's a little different, it seems to me. When it's a purchase power agreement, it's not directly tied to the fuel cost that they're realizing.
That's a good point.
So anyway,
Alana, you mentioned not having the resources to do extensive studies on, you know, all these separate smaller deals. But don't we get money to do that when we do a CPCN? And isn't that effectively granting them the ability to put that cost into their rates?
Well, if they were doing a certificate of public convenience necessity, you can set a fee. You know, we don't have it automatic, but like you come in and ask, and then it would be the capital investment, and you would have that fee in order to figure out if you thought it was the right thing or wrong thing, you know, if you had to hire an expert or something to put it in rates.
But the PCNN is not required for a purchase agreement.
Right. That's only if you're building something in North Dakota.
Yeah.
That's why, like, Border Winds PCNN is. So if you have a wind farm in Minnesota or South Dakota and you're going to buy the power, we have a rule that says the purchase power costs can be one of the little items in your things that go in the fuel adjustment. And when we have another rule that says we can investigate and audit anything that's going on in the fuel adjustment. But when I said resources, we could open a case and do that. But if you were thinking, and I'm guessing, that you might need to hire somebody to assist with that, you don't have that pot of money to hire, say, a consultant.
Okay. When does their cost of a purchase power agreement get flushed out in comparison to something? Like when they're going to build something, they come in for an ADP, let's say, and they flush out all their costs. When do they have to true up what their cost to purchase power agreement is compared to something else?
The true up, there is a true up in the fuel cost adjustment on the energy costs. If you get a purchase power agreement that would have a demand component with it too, so there would be a KW charge and a kilowatt hour charge.
I mean,
there would be no true up on the KW charges.
But when do you compare though to something? I guess that's a better way to phrase it. When would you compare? Okay, let's say they buy this for $1 a megawatt, right? And that's what their agreement is. But they don't ever have to. Do they ever have to compare it to us to say they could have bought it this, and this for different rates and different generations?
Not unless we challenge them on it.
Well, or when they ask for an ADP, you might be doing it then. Just, you know, is this
they don't
the
do
right
ADPs
thing to
for
do?
Purchase power agreements.
They can do
they
an
can.
ADP for a purchase power okay. agreement.
They don't do PC&Ns.
Do they have to?
We told them they have to, and that's why you have a slew of them here now. So
how do we get ourselves wrapped around the axle with they already entered into this one? Because it wasn't timely, right?
Geronimo, well, that was part, they came in after it was signed, and then they promised to come in early, and now you have five
now
or six.
Now we have
of,
them.
So can we say that if we can get through this Geronimo thing, we might have a model then we can do something with? Because that was the stink of the Geronimo one, is they came in after they'd already made the decision.
Right.
And so we threw it back to them saying it wasn't timely. And then we disallowed the fuel recovery costs because the whole thing was a mess.
We said we're going to look at that
it's part
in
of
the
this.
Next rate case. You know, and so that one, I think...
It could have just as well been... If I'd had my way, we'd have disallowed that.
Right.
And then we'd have said it's not timely and we disallow it. We'd have been done
right.
with it.
So that one is a good example of being in the middle where there's, you know... A decision on prudence, but the actual recovery of the rates. Because remember, the conversation in Geronimo was, we could have just put these numbers in our fuel adjustment. It is subject to staff review, commission denial, and all those things, but they just file them, and we have not challenged them that way.
That is a good point. We did kind of get an agreement that they would file ADPs for purchase power agreements. I can't remember what the parameters of that were now, though, if they're certain size agreements or something like that.
It was in the
previous case. It was in a case.
We
can look it up.
Well,
I don't know that there was a lot of parameters.
ADPs were in the previous rate case order. I think ADPs on purchase power might have been later. They're all looking at me. They're all going to get me when I get in the hall and fix it.
Exchanges back and forth, and the company said, we'll do this.
Yeah.
Well, going forward, I guess,
this is why some states have annual rate cases, because then everything's just in one case once a year.
Okay. We had another meeting at 10, but I got time between now and do you have more time? Are we good? I don't go past an hour unless you guys are.
I have one issue for you is, you set a hearing date, November 1, for those wind contracts, and then somehow they got pulled off the agenda. If we don't issue that notice now, you can't make that hearing date.
Because we hadn't decided, I mean, the problem is, you can't make if you don't decide it or get a stipulation, you can't make the hearing date anyway, because you got them pending in here.
Okay, back up again.
Jerry's kind of switching until he wants the notice on the agenda, but there's a
I remember the discussion. We needed to make a decision here, and that was what my point of. We agreed that we were pulling all those out. So doesn't that mean we have to schedule that hearing?
You did schedule the hearing for November. It's on your calendar. October 31st and November 1, is it?
Right.
And if you want to make that date, we need to issue that notice now.
Understood. But us agreeing that we wanted. I think we agreed.
I didn't think the group agreed. I think we've had a lot of conversations, but this was the place to decide.
Okay, well,
I guess
my thought would be that we've had the discussion that we're going to remove those things from this rate case.
Okay.
But we didn't offer my call.
I agree. I thought that was decided during the hearings.
Well, you know, I don't It seems backwards to me that we're going through all this and not just putting everything all together. However, I think even our advocacy witness said that it would be good
to have a separate
pull them out. So
they didn't build a case here.
And running around the track.
I can't make a good case for holding it all together, except for that it just seems logical. But
we didn't get any
all the expertise is so that they should be separate.
We didn't have it noticed. There's a lot of reasons, but because the question was raised, then you need that commission direction, absent a stipulation from the parties that I thought might have come in, like, in the next day afterwards, but it didn't. You need the commission direction, and we'll probably have a line or two in this notice about
it. Well, I think I just heard everybody here say separate proceedings.
Okay.
So do we need a special meeting then, or do we?
I can have you a notice for tomorrow's meeting. We just need to add it back on.
Okay. That sounds reasonable
just
to me.
Permission out
of okay.
Okay. All right. And then it's up to everybody to get all their work done by that time, and it just, that's a whole other, because I see that as a whole other separation.
And then, when you're going through the answering of the rate case, the question of ADP on those and the PCNN, I guess there's five of them, isn't there? Or four, I don't know, is not in the rate case.
I mean, but for Geronimo, it still is.
Yes.
Yeah.
For Geronimo,
that's
what
you
it
can't
still
say
is.
It's, there's that line of what is going to be in these cases. And
but Geronimo's not in that
particular
batch.
Particular cases here that they filed
with
ADPs and PCNNs, border winds and those projects.
Yeah.
Well, I like having them out of this case because, well, that's obviously what we're doing.
One more thing.
Sure.
Are we done on that? The ADPs?
Unless we come back later.
Okay. One thing that I just wanted to make sure that we're getting, because I'm expecting it, when Mr. O'Connor, or Ms., I don't remember if it was he or a she, but O'Connor, the witness, was talking about nuclear issues.
Oh, the cast storage.
I asked what concessions were made to state regulators to get the authorization to increase storage. And that witness, in my notes, indicated that just didn't know. And my point here is, if you run out of storage and there's nowhere to go with it, you're out of storage. I can understand that you have to build additional casks, and I don't mind our ratepayers paying for that because we get electricity from there. But if what it took to get the votes was, you know, building a softball field in town X, you know, I don't think our ratepayers ought to pay for the softball field. And I'm just throwing out a wild example. But I would like to know that information, what concessions were made, so we can decide for ourselves whether we think our ratepayers ought to pay for it.
One of the missing late filed exhibits. Well, they have a late filed exhibit. They were supposed to report all of it.
Oh, okay.
And it's not here yet.
Well, and that's a very good follow-through, but it does go back to going forward. If we clamp down on charitable contributions and economic development, they won't have the ability to do that going forward anyway with ratepayer dollars. They could do it with shareholder dollars.
I'm not sure in this case that they would look at that. It'd be an accounting question. I don't know if they would look at some of the concessions that may have been required by their regulatory body and their legislature in order to get that all done. I don't know what was all done back then. It's a while back, and I think we ought to know that.
Did you say we do have an exhibit on it?
They were supposed to send it, yes.
Okay, because there was a renewable development fund.
Oh.
Remember that?
I do now.
Yeah.
And Grand Forks was getting some of it. And I guess that somehow or other that we quit paying for that back in the previous case, I think, if I remember right. I think they also was tied to their wind mandate. And I don't know what else.
Okay, so more to come on that.
Yeah, those previous cases, it's worth going over them with a kind of a fine look, because there's things in there that we have said that we have to be aware of. I had forgotten about the renewable development being in that one.
I've wondered this over the last 8 months now, going through these things in our orders, and this is a very silly question, but we make these orders. Who makes sure we're following up on them?
The Director of Compliance, that's why he's got that name.
With all
it's a lot things. To keep track of.
It's a huge amount to keep track of, and some of it's been like, I mean, some we've developed some methodology through case management and other, and I don't know, the rest of it must be Pat's spreadsheet.
So we went and asked for another public utilities position, but honestly, because there's just no way these guys can.
Well, how many times have we said just in the last hour, oh, I think we put that in the last rate case.
Yes,
and
I know.
Some of it you just get from memory, I guess.
Well, that's
Jerry remembered the renewable development thing just from memory. I didn't, but yes.
Huh. Have we ever, do we ever check with other states to see what kind of, like, computer tracking systems they use for this type of thing, or I mean,
I haven't ever checked for an internal, like a staff level workload management. I mean, there are other things that you can buy for legal. I've never checked with other, like,
I bet the companies have a way to keep track of all this stuff.
Yeah, and a lot more people to do it.
Somebody that says, oh, they're never going to ask about this one.
Jerry, real quick, your thoughts on the transmission cost recovery rider?
I think they have a statute that says they can have that. And we have some flexibility on implementing it.
So there's North Dakota law that says they required to a transmission cost recovery rider?
Not required. They may. There's a law that says they may. Yes.
Does an auto tail
and it says what it should be like.
I believe they do.
It says we get to say okay or tweak it or whatever, and then when they file rates under it, they have to prove reasonableness and we can challenge. And there's an application fee for that to investigate.
Seems like we went through the Otter Tail proceeding and the MDU proceeding on the rider.
The policy changes, though, I guess? How do you feel with, okay, right now the cost allocation in MISO is favorable to us, finally. But if they change the cost allocation for transmission, it could hurt us really bad. And so the companies might be less likely to worry about it because they'll just pass through those costs.
Well, the stuff that gets allocated right now are the MVP projects and the MEP projects.
But if they change that?
They did have reliability projects being allocated on a different allocation factor, just more locally in nature, and they changed it to quit doing that. I don't think they can change the allocation on the existing MVP projects. If they do it, it would be on a going forward basis. But what we negotiated to get kilowatt hour charges across the footprint is in place for these 17 projects that right now in this portfolio that's approved.
You don't have any concerns with
going forward? Not on that. Okay. They could change something looking forward, but we deal with it at that time, and it would be the stakeholder process that it went through in order to get it changed, and we'd be participating in that.
So we'd go through that more than try to go back at each rate case. I see. Okay.
Right now, the MISO costs, I believe, are being recovered through the fuel cost adjustment.
Okay.
Well, okay. Except for a couple things. The Schedule 10 charges aren't, and I don't believe the MVP charges will be either.
Okay, thanks, Jerry.
And Jerry, are MISO revenues recovered through the fuel adjustment for all the companies? That other jurisdictions would pay back to the transmission owner?
They're not really.
Or are they just offset over what you end up paying MISO somehow?
Yeah, it depends on what you're talking about coming back. There's TLR revenues. They're not TLR, but transmission revenue rights. If you own the line, you get congestion charges from them. I'd expect that to come back through the MISO billing, through the fuel cost adjustment.
Okay.
There's also a difference in your loss calculations. They charge for a marginal loss component, and then refund the difference between that and an average. I would expect that refund would be in there, too.
Okay. But then if you were just getting revenue because of contribution of other states, it'd be in the transmission rider or in base rates, if you had a transmission rider. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, the MVP revenues, for instance, that Ottertail will be getting, a portion of them would come back through the fuel cost adjustment in accordance with what was ordered in that case. That the commission considered this. We had a hearing and everything on that, if you remember.
I do. Okay, thanks, Jerry. Julie, you had a follow-up? Then
Randy's got not on transmission costs.
On something.
The one other thing that I thought there was a huge difference on during the hearing was the test year. And Dante Mugrace's testimony, where he went through and trued up some of the costs to actuals, and the company used a straight projection on the test year. It didn't seem like they did a lot of the, you know, testing to show that it's reasonable, reliable, and was made in good faith, based on actuals.
The company did not submit some of the statutory requirements.
Yeah. So how do we deal with this? And how does it affect the overall outcome? I mean, where do we go with the whole revenue requirement as a result of these two very different cases here? Is this something, Josh, you can dig into? Or
I think you decide based on your evidence which one you want to believe.
Well, if we decided in favor of Dante's, the case would be over. He says they have too much revenue.
Well, but he's using everybody else's numbers, too, like the 1CP. So everybody uses everybody else's numbers.
Right.
So if you and when you see those issues, you'll know more about what does.
So this will come out when they get. Is this going to be more clear when they come together with their sheet of here's kind of our where we're at. Here's our side. Here's their side. Here's where we agree, that document on the financials.
Yeah, I hope.
We have to establish a test year revenue requirement in our order. Or revenue.
Yeah.
This is what we're getting for revenue, and then this is what we need, and the difference will be the requirement that we have to come up with.
Yeah.
The amount of the increase.
Yeah, at the end of the day, that's the big number that comes out.
What did you guys, where are you on that issue?
You know, I guess I never thought about it too much, because I was thinking about once we get all those numbers, we'll probably have a range that we can go with.
I think the sort of policy or legal conclusion that you need to make one way or the other is whether it's reasonable to use historical information in order, as he said up there 20 mm-hmm. times, in order to test the validity of the projection. And that's why I brought up the statute in the questioning, that the statute requires that to be filed when you have a future test year, way in the beginning, 9 months earlier, so that people looking at it can test the validity of the projection. So, you know, if the company didn't file it, I mean, you could do something as simple as requiring them to file it. Because remember, he didn't have he wanted more than he got. He got some. He wanted more. And it's, you know, something you can require the company to file.
That's
but I think you can decide which of those you think is the right way to do it.
But as this thing moves forward, you know, a lot of these things we're talking about are going to be very, very small amounts in the overall rate.
Oh, yes, exactly.
But they're, you know, the charitable contributions is going to be just minuscule.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. But yet it's a key point that we talk about.
It's more principal than money.
Yeah, right. Absolutely. Yeah. So the money and this is for the company and advocacy staff, the money that we're haggling over here is probably a very small amount. So it's better that they figured this out, in my opinion.
You know, the big issue on revenue is how much are they going to sell? What's your load forecast?
Right.
So I don't think we really went after their load forecast.
No, I don't think we did either.
Okay.
That's where the money is.
In many businesses, the difference between the successful ones and the unsuccessful ones isn't the big issues, because those are pretty obvious.
Right.
It's the things that get neglected or done wastefully that eventually add up and cause the unsuccessful ones to become unsuccessful. And so I think we have to look at the small things as well. The big ones are usually pretty obvious.
But your compensation discussion is huge.
Pension.
Oh, yeah, pension. I'm sorry. All right. I don't have anything for the now. Julie, do you have anything else?
No.
Anything else?
Nothing more.
Okay, so let's schedule another work session tomorrow on this. We'll just put it out there ways down the road. Okay.
So add to scheduling.
Add to scheduling. And we'll put it out there another, I don't know, another 3 weeks or something. Mm-hmm. So, okay, on that, we'll close the work session on case number PU12-813. Thank you.
Dave, if you can hang around for 2 minutes.
No, I think we're right.
Dave and Patrick.
I think we're right here.
Yeah.
Okay. It's just a...
It's just IT people, right?
Yeah.